Good morning. My topic today is to look at some different ways of approaching the history of discourse markers, pragmatic markers in general, in any language, but particularly in English. I think it's really important to look at alternative points of view, because even if one doesn't agree with them, just the very fact of seeing that you don't agree can be enlightening and clarify what one does think about a particular issue. And it's also the case that very often that there's some very important nuggets in what is said in a different perspective. So first half today, I'm going to look at the grammaticalization hypothesis. I participated in that. I don't believe in it anymore, but a lot of people have discussed it in the last 20 years or so. And I would make a much briefer look at the pragmaticalization hypothesis, which was a hypothesis that grew up in the late 90s, but I don't think it's practiced very much anymore. I will discuss that and why. After the break, I'm going to look at what is called discourse grammar. It's a dual level grammar that Bernd Heine, Günther Kaltenbrück, Tanya Kutubova, and Haiping Long have been working on, and have a book forthcoming at Oxford University Press. It's a typological study of the rise of discourse markers across a variety of languages. And they have a hypothesis that discourse markers are co-opted to what they call thetical grammar. If that's not familiar to you, I will explain what it is when I get there. So let's start with the grammaticalization hypothesis. As I have said, most pragmatic markers and discourse structuring markers in particular originate in contentful lexical expressions. There are very few exceptions, and the exceptions are things like oh and as I mentioned yesterday. Because pragmatic markers in general and discourse markers in particular originate in contentful lexical expressions, it seemed natural in the 1990s to think of their histories in the terms of grammaticalization. You might recall from lecture 3 that May said that the grammaticalization of certain words creates new forms and introduces categories which had no linguistic expression. It changes the system as a whole. I suggested such a perspective, a grammaticalization perspective on pragmatic markers in 1995 as a revised version in 1997 that has been floating around. This is a paper that was never published because once I had given it, I started to think about constructionalization and I didn't think it was very relevant anymore, but people seem to find it and use it and find it useful for either for their own work postulating grammaticalization or to argue against it. So it has had a very active offstage life in this paper. One thing that I think is a big problem when we discuss grammaticalization is that we don't really say what we mean by grammar. There's been some kind of assumption by people like Lehmann that grammar is a very restrictive, structurally formal affair. And you will find that Heine and Kaltenbrück and Kutubova and Long pick that up in their dual level grammar. what happens when you look at the development of pragmatic markers is that you realize that grammar conceived in this narrow way simply cannot encompass them. So in that 1995 paper, I attempted to think about what kind of grammar one needs in order to encompass them. And I suggested, this is from the paper, grammar structures cognitive and communicative aspects of language. It encompasses not only phonology, morphosyntax, and semantics, but also inferences that arise out of linguistic form. In other words, linguistic pragmatics, such as topicalization, deixis. Now, some 15 plus years later, I agree with that statement in general, but I would replace linguistic pragmatics by conventionalized pragmatics. I think that's what I meant back then. And I would replace form by expressions, because from a constructional point of view, form would exclude meaning, and I don't want that to happen there. Inferences that arise out of linguistic expressions, in other words, conventionalized pragmatics such as topicalization and deixis. I wasn't the only person who was interested in extending grammar in this kind of way. Many people have been, among them Degas and Evers Vermeulen, who suggest that discourse markers are encompassed by grammar provided it is conceptualized broadly to include discourse pragmatic elements. And Hazelot, 2013, has argued for what he calls a wide conception of grammar. Hans-Jürg Schmidt, in 2017, and many others, have been suggesting that view of grammar in general, whether or not you're working on pragmatic markers, needs to be a little bit more all-encompassing than the original idea that we had in the 80s and 90s. I will say that when I produced that definition of grammar and suggested that pragmatic markers were examples of grammaticalization, there was a lot of upset. One of my good colleagues said that I was undermining grammaticalization. Well, I wasn't intending to undermine grammaticalization. I was intending to look at it from a different perspective. Now, part of my argument that pragmatic markers are part of grammar in this paper is that there has been a preclausal slot from the time of the very first attested text in English, that means from about 650 on, and in earlier Germanic as well, that includes Gothic, which is a 4th century language, or it's translation of the Bible, actually. And here a speaker's assessment of the upcoming clause is expressed in the preclausal slot. The kinds of adverbs that could occur in this slot are really quite limited. The adverbials usually found there include truth intensifiers like sortliche, which means truly, withodliche, which means assuredly, and evaluatives such as wunderliche, which means wonderfully, and silliche, which means strangely. An example. Sortliche itself alphaotic. Truly, I myself am alien. That's from one of Alpert's homilies. He wrote a very large number of sermons, which in those days were called homilies. And from another homily, withodliche, immerion, is Ara Magna Moda. Truly, moderation is of all virtues, mother. So moderation is the mother of all virtues. Sophia is there preceding a clause. I myself am alien. Vitodice truly is there before a clause. Moderation is the mother of all virtues. I don't see any way in which that initial slot can be considered to be extra sentential, although people have, because it doesn't fit a kind of generative view of constructions and of expor syntax. What's in that slot is not part of the argument of this clause. But I would argue, and I did argue in that paper, that different parts of the sentence have different functions. So this initial slot doesn't necessarily have to be a place for an argument. It's a kind of intuitive statement, but I think we do have to accept that most languages have slots either at the beginning or at the end. Japanese are often at the end, depends a little bit on the word order. But most languages do in fact have a slot that's pre-clausal, that's pre what most grammarians would call a legitimate sentence. I don't use the word sentence because sentence is a very loaded term. It is related to a particular kind of syntax, but these kinds of things like moderation is all virtues, mother is a clause, it's also a sentence, but that's okay. My idea that different parts of the grammar have different functions has been elaborated on. I don't know that it was my idea, but the idea that different parts of the grammar have different functions is developed in Haselow 2019, who argues that position and order of discourse markers is dependent on the communicative tasks at hand. I will discuss that briefly in lecture 9. It's an interesting way of approaching the linear composition and linear architecture of the clause. He is particularly interested in conversation and in turn-taking. That is not so relevant for the historical data, but I think we can extrapolate from conversational data to the whole business of how we use language and why we use language, and think about the tasks to which it is put. And once we do that, I think the initial slot comes to be a very interesting locus for various markers that are not part of the syntax of the sentence, that is true, but that have pragmatic evaluative functions. So that was one reason that I, in 1995, began to think that we needed to expand our notion of grammar. As I mentioned, I never published that paper because I subsequently started expanding the notion of grammar with construction grammar. But going back to 1995, what was I thinking about specifically in terms of grammaticalization? I was thinking that all the examples that we have, after all, is the one I looked at last time. We'll be looking at more, but I think everybody would agree that the examples in any language involve bleaching. That is loss of content meaning. After all, is no longer temporal. and is no longer about everything. This is an example of something that is on the strong end of Lehmann's integrity parameter, but a weak case of grammaticalization, gets bleached, gets attenuated, and comes to be on the stronger end of the grammaticalization parameter. So we have bleaching. I think that's very obvious with every single one of the pragmatic markers and the discourse markers in the narrower sense. We have bonding within the phrase or univibration. So it's a very clear example because it was written as two words, L, which is exactly, it means all, and so. And then it was combined as one word. After all, never was combined as one word, but that doesn't matter. I think we do think of it as one word. That's Lehmann's coalescence. And there is decategorialization. Prototypical properties of nouns, verbs, and adjectives are weakened. And by the way, the way is a path, a route, a road. It's originally a noun. But once it comes to be a discourse structuring marker, one cannot modify that noun with an adjective. You can't, by the rocky way is fine, but it doesn't have a discourse structured function. And all the same, we have an adjective. Same cannot modify a noun or be modified by markers such as exact, as in all the exact same questions. All the exact same questions is perfectly good modern English, but it does not have a discourse structure marker function. Laurel Brinkman picked that up, and in her 2008 book suggests, in addition, some phenomena that Hopper, 1991, considers to be principles of grammaticalization. Among them, I'm sorry, there's a typo, but among them, layering, the coexistence of older and newer forms. I mentioned that before. So we have the pronominal source after all, meaning after everything, coexisting with a discourse structure marker after all, meaning this is my reason for saying what I just said. And they are layered and they coexist through the 19th century. That is no longer the case. One simply doesn't find after all, meaning after all this in modern English. Coker doesn't have any examples, but it has plenty of examples of after all this. So layering can obsolesce. It's not surprising. After all, in its old meaning, does not have to continue to be used in exactly the same way over several centuries. In addition to layering, Brinkman points to persistence. Some traces of the source meaning may be found in and may constrain the uses of a discourse structuring marker. We'll see this in the case of further, meaning in addition, and moreover, that's the meaning of further that I'm thinking about. And in by the way, because the sense of some kind of path continues for a while in the history, by the way. So these properties that I've just mentioned of pragmatic markers as they arise, and the properties of some connectors led myself Britain and others to favor a grammaticalization analysis of the rise of pragmatic workers. There is also the interesting to me idea, not sure how many other people thought it was interesting, but I was interested in the idea that the rise of discourse markers might be an example of Meyer's idea that grammaticalization introduces categories which had no linguistic expression, changes the system as a whole. They do not represent that particular formulation in toto, but they have elements, they show elements in their histories that seem to pertain to that way of thinking about grammaticalization. If you look at the old English data, you will find and but. These are clearly very, we find and, we don't find but, we find arc, but the meaning of but. And I'm going to discuss that. And there are several epistemic markers like we told this year, which meant truly, as I said, in Old English. And some expressions like new or now, that just as in modern English can be used both with the temporal meaning and with a discourse structuring meaning, which is pay attention, I'm changing my topic. So there were things like and the equivalent of but, which as I say was arc. There was tha and thane, two adverbials that meant then, that were also used to do topic focus work together with word order. But otherwise, there were only a few markers that were used to do discourse structuring work. I would say less than a handful. If you look at the history of English, you will find that the number of pragmatic markers and discourse structuring markers in particular increases throughout history. In Middle English, we get a number of markers, especially epistemic ones like no doubt, coming into being. By the 17th century, there's an absolute profusion of new discourse structuring markers. Among them, after all, which I talked about yesterday, by the way, which I will talk about. And when I do, I will point out that to my knowledge, there was no dedicated marker of digression until the 17th century. There were, however, markers of topic shift, of which, by the way, is a member. The new DSMs did not change the system in the sense of changing the syntax, because elements, expressions in the initial slot have been around forever, as I mentioned, but they did change the rhetorical and especially written practices. Typically, as I said, they originated in lexical adverbial phrases in English. And my guess is the reasons for the growing profusion of the DSMs is probably sociocultural. Latin texts, many of which were translated into Old English, attest to extensive use of discourse structuring markers. Caroline Krohn, K-R-O-O-N, wrote a book about them in Latin. They are very clearly adverbs that are used pragmatically, just as items like however and nevertheless are used in modern English. But this appears to have had very little effect on Old English rhetorical practices. Somewhat of a surprise, because you find translations that for the most part leave them out. We begin to get a lot more influence of the Latin and at the time French texts in Middle English, that's the period from around 1100 to 1500. And then there's an explosion of interest in copying styles from Latin, Greek, and French in the early modern English period. It's part of the Renaissance, and it's part of a shift in thinking. So I think that the influence of late medieval and Renaissance thought on the discourse structuring, marker inventory, and on rhetorical styles would have been an interesting topic to investigate. It's not core linguistics, I understand that. But I do think that it's difficult to understand the history of the pragmatic markers without some awareness of their role in essentially in rhetorical styles. I'll say a bit more about that later. But anyway, coming back to the grammaticalization hypothesis. The grammaticalization hypothesis looked promising, but there was a major problem. And this problem is that in some respects, the development of discourse structuring markers goes directly counter to Lehmann's grammaticalization parameters. Syntactic scope expands. But every adverb that becomes a discourse structuring marker, it was part of the argument structure. They went to Rome after all, after this. They went to dinner, was my example yesterday. They went to dinner after all, everything. After all the speeches had been made, they went to dinner. That's not an argument of the clause. But syntactic scope expands for the discourse markers for Lehmann. Syntactic scope contracts. In some cases, such as after all, and by the way, the discourse structuring marker is quite mobile and can occur in initial and final positions. It may occasionally be used in medial position. I mentioned yesterday, it can occur, after all can occur with B in medial position. But often the function is not truly connected there. And for Lehmann, syntactic variability contracts. So that's the second problem. Two things that Lehmann said contracts, in fact, expand in the case of discourse structuring markers. So syntactic scope expands and mobility expands. So this led me to suggest that the concept of grammaticalization should be revised to allow for scope expansion and increased syntactic mobility. And that's where there was a great outcry, which is fine because it got people thinking about what kind of grammar we need in order to account for these markers. I mentioned that before that Brinton, like myself, thought that it was important to think about modifying the view of grammar that was currently around at the time. She says, Lehmann's parameters are salient, but not necessary features of grammaticalization. In fact, what one sees in the case of pragmatic markers is the feature of grammaticalization that Heine, in a 2003 article, terms context generalization. So the context expand, or Himmelmann in 2004 named syntactic expansion. I talked about that the other day, in which a grammaticalized form comes to pertain to a larger number of contexts, such as clause initial, clause medial, and clause final position. Now, what Himmelmann talks about is what is called host class expansion. There was a question about that. That's basically that you, a dependent finds that the head that is available for it is more and more and more expanded. So my example was, would be going to, be going to verb, you could only have, in the verb slot, you could only have a verb that one could reasonably go somewhere to do. Once be going to future arose, the verb could be all kinds of things, not only those verbs like marry and visit, but also like and think and experiential verbs. But in this case, Brinton is suggesting another kind of syntactic expansion is use in initial, medial, and final position. And now that there's a different way to account for pragmatic markers, and in many cases, concepts of grammar have been expanded, I don't any longer feel the necessity to try to revise the definition of grammaticalization to include them. I think what we need is an expanded view of what grammar is. And that will naturally give us an expanded view of grammaticalization. Kutivar et al.'s characterization seems very useful for current thinking about change. Grammaticalization concerns the genesis and development of grammatical forms. But of course, it does depend on what is meant by grammatical forms. Kutivar et al. Mean tense aspect, case, and complementizer. Question arises whether that should also include pragmatic markers. Probably shouldn't, because they're not really grammatical forms in the way that tense, aspect, and case are. However, they are all procedurals. So people were thinking a lot in the 90s about how to incorporate history or just the presence of pragmatic markers in grammar. And one proposal was that we should think about pragmaticalization as a separate process from grammaticalization. And some people who put that point of view forward include Ehrman and Kotsinas in 1993, Eimer in 1997, Frank Job in 2006, and Dosti in 2009. These researchers, for the most part, suggested that the development of pragmatic markers and discourse markers of the kind I'm looking at in particular did not necessarily go through a grammaticalization stage. Rather, they were used somewhat directly in a syntactically detached way. When I mean rather directly, I mean they didn't go through a grammaticalization stage. These researchers focused on syntactic detachability, the fact that a pragmatic marker can appear at the beginning of a clause or the end and have a break. In that sense, they are disjuncts. There was a question about them yesterday. Disjuncts will typically have an intonation break, so they have a distinct prosody. They have high pragmatic content, and there's little significant phonological reduction. That is true of pretty much all pragmatic markers. After all, is as far as we can tell, very similar to what it was originally in Old English, after L. Also is one of the most reduced ones we have, is AL Swa, but by the way, is hardly reduced. So there's very little phonological reduction. One would expect that in the case of grammaticalization, but we don't find it. So these researchers suggested that we should think about a different process from grammaticalization. We should think of a process of pragmaticalization, where a pragmatic meaning arose directly over time. And this is Dosti, who says, the term pragmaticalization refers to a process of linguistic change in which a full lexical item or grammatical item changes category and status and becomes a pragmatic item. That is an item which is not fully integrated into the syntactic structure of the utterance and which has a textual or interpersonal meaning. So a full lexical item would be something like truly or really, or a grammatical item would, in her view, be something like a prepositional phrase is an adverbial, as in after all. So it changes category and status and becomes a pragmatic item. Or we could say speakers use a full lexical item or grammatical item as a pragmatic item. And a pragmatic item is one that is not fully integrated into the syntactic structure of the utterance. And it has a textual or interpersonal meaning. So the textual meaning is the kind of meaning I'm focusing on, connecting discourse segment one and discourse segment two. And the interpersonal meaning is more like the development of politeness markers and hedging uses of by the way, and other interpersonal uses. Now, the idea of pragmaticalization has proved very attractive because it doesn't require an intermediary grammaticalization stage, although when I look at the data, there very often is one. But questions have been raised whether we really need to have an independent process of change that results only in pragmatic markers. For those who care about Occam's razor and simplicity, both in research and in conceptualizations and ideologies and theories, having pragmaticalization in addition to grammaticalization seems like overkill because it really has only one function. And the general consensus nowadays appears to be that pragmaticalization is not needed as a process independent of other types of change. People have suggested that it would be preferable to subsume the processes Dosti identifies under one of these three things. A more encompassing view of grammaticalization than the traditional one, that is Degan and Simon van den Bergen in 2011 and Diewald in 2011. Or it could be included in a broad view of what grammar is, and that's Hazelow's suggestion. And I think we could say that diachronic construction grammar is also a broad view of what grammar is. And although in the past it has, diachronic construction grammar has not paid much attention to pragmatic expressions, it certainly can. And I'm working on being sure that it does. And the third possibility is to have a different model altogether, such as discourse grammar that Heine and his colleagues have developed. And that is what I'm going to discuss after the break. So let's have a break now, 5 minutes as usual, and I will discuss that. I think the most widely discussed alternative perspective on the rise of pragmatic markers in general to the grammaticalization hypothesis is the discourse grammar hypothesis. It has been developed by people who have many decades of history in the background of working on grammaticalization, but they do not find grammaticalization a satisfactory model for the development of pragmatic markers. Bernd Heine, in particular, who, as you know, has worked on grammaticalization since, well, I think his first publication was 1984, but anyway, a long time. Günter Kaltenberg, Tanya Kutova, who's written many books on grammaticalization with Bernd Heine, and Haiping Wang, who has also worked very extensively on grammaticalization. And in various combinations, some alone and some together, they have proposed that in order to think about pragmatic markers, we need a model which is a dual level grammar. It has two domains. It has a sentence grammar and it has a thetical grammar, and I will explain these momentarily. They draw on a functional discourse grammar model produced by Hengewald and McKenzie in 2008, which also makes this two-domain distinction. Now, start with sentence grammar. Sentence grammar is essentially old-style core grammar. It is restricted to internal constituent structures. It is organized in terms of parts of speech or constituent types, such as sentences, clauses, phrases, words, and morphemes, plus the morphosyntactic machinery to relate constituents to each other. That is any kind of standard grammar. The sentence grammar component is sufficiently fixed and constrained in order to work as a system of word order and other conventions that allow for cohesive linear flow and planning. That's Kaltenberg and Heine in 2014. It's essentially what people call core grammar, the kind of grammar that has a long history going all the way back to the Greeks. Thetical grammar is something very different. You will recognize that thetical is short for parenthetical. And everything in thetical grammar includes linguistic units beyond the sentence that are syntactically, semantically, and typically also prosodically detached from expressions of sentence grammar. Beyond the sentence, key here, they are extra grammatical, extra sentential. They are what I think I yesterday compared to super segmentals in phonology. And I very particularly used that comparison because super segmentals in old style phonology were in fact add-on elements. They aren't anymore, they have been integrated, but they used to be add-on elements. And you'll see how this works with thetical grammar. Key to pragmatic markers is the fact that thetical units are co-opted. And co-optation is a cognitive communicative operation whereby pieces of discourse located in one domain are transferred to another domain. Presumably by speakers, though there are no speakers in that particular quotation. A cognitive communicative operation whereby pieces of discourse located in one domain are transferred to another. The one domain that they're taken from is sentence grammar. Constraints on co-optation are essentially semantic. What matters is that the speaker honors the principles of relevance to enable the hearer to establish a cognitive link between the two parts of the utterance. So coherence really pertains to relevance, a cognitive link between two parts of the utterance. There are also constraints on syntactic position. It is the pragmatics of discourse, most of all the semantic interaction of the co-opted unit, that appears to constrain placement. So the pragmatics of discourse is includes such things as how you put things together. That's a Haslow kind of question. How do you put things in sequence so that they make sense and are comprehensible to the listener? Verticals, as I said, are extra sentential co-opted units. Most are considered to be the result of transfer from sentence grammar to vertical grammar. There are some exceptions. And Heine and his colleagues very specifically mentioned interjections such as O, and hesitation markers such as mm, presumably because these have no lexical or contentful cognates that you could take out of sentence grammar. Antitheticals are of three types. There are instantaneous antitheticals. These are fully compositional units that can be spontaneously co-opted anytime from sentence grammar. And this set, I think, is absolutely well supported in one. We did feel, a union council was 2 weeks ago when this was put to us, that the increase from 7 to 16 was actually a very good idea. That's from ICEGB, the International Corpus of English of Great Britain, spoken. Very typical. I found myself doing this, even in a lecture mode, but certainly in a conversation mode, I do it all the time. I have a particular thing to say. In this case, we felt that the increase from 7 to 16 was actually a very good idea. And then something pops in my mind and I think about, well, there's a little something that I should add in here. Union Council was 2 weeks ago when this was put to us. So this particular speaker had in mind to say that the increase was a good idea. And in the middle of saying that thought, it would be good to put a time frame into when they thought it. Now that kind of co-optation from sentences is, I think, very well supported. Then there are constructional theticals. And these are also compositional. You can fully understand the parts. They have meaningful parts. They are co-opted units, recurrent patterns with a schematic form or function, such as a reportative quoting clause or a non-restrictive, a positive relative. Here is an example of a reportative quoting clause. This in the literature is called inquits or quotatives, or a variety of other things that have to do with how you report a particular way of speaking or speaking at all. My name is Handy Earnshaw, slur the drunk, old Mr. Earnshaw's eldest son. So we're supposed to slur that, right? The point is that slur the drunk in there is schematic in the sense that it is a quotative. Said the drunk, sang the drunk, said he. Notice the word order there. This is a fixed, archaic piece of syntax. So it has a schematic form. You can put all kinds of verbs in that slot and all kinds of nouns. Said he, she, the king, the pauper, and anybody, including the drunk there. So that any noun, any verb of locution that fits, and any noun that names a person who could say something can go there. So it's schematic, very schematic. The suggestion is that this is co-opted, but I'm not quite sure from what, because slurred the drunk is no good in modern syntax. That is old syntax, that's old English syntax, which puts the verb first. But it is the standard way of saying somebody said something. Look at a children's storybook and you will say, said he, said she, said the fox, etc. That's how you do it. Or it's one of the ways you could do it. This is a very recurrent pattern. It is very schematic, that is true. It is constructional and it is composition. All of those are true. The issue is exactly what are they opted out of? They say they're anchored in hosts, like slurred the drunk is anchored in the quotation. Yes, it is. You would never have verb of locution subject without having a quotation. So that's the second type. The third type is formulaic theticals. These are non-compositional, morphosyntactically unanalyzable, and usually short. For example, anyway, however, as it were. Now I put some exclamation marks and an asterisk there for unanalyzable. Surely that's analyzable anyway. It is not compositional. We don't compose any as a indefinite quantifier and way as path for anyway. We don't compose how plus ever for however, or as and it and were for as it were. It's non-compositional, but more for syntactically it is analyzable, because you can see that there are two morphemes, any and way and how and ever, and as it were. It's things like goner that are unanalyzable because you don't know how to split that up into its parts anymore. And Heine et al. In press book, and I have permission from Heine to quote from it, cite Haslow's 2015 study of anyway. And the example, it's Haslow's example. I seem to get slower And I don't walk very well nowadays. Anyway, what can one expect? Now that anyway is no doubt a pragmatic marker. It is a discourse structuring marker. It says I'm treating what's coming up as a kind of, I've thought about this, but I can't do anything about it. A kind of throwaway. Again, this is from ICGB. Anyway originated in Alden's any way, any path. And three, it's no longer part of the meaning of its host sentence. Its validity is not bound to or inferentially linked to the content of its host. It has detached itself from the sentence grammar unit. I think there's a reification problem here. It, anyway, surely doesn't co-opt itself. It's people who co-opt it. But anyway, just things to be aware of in one speaking. And I know yesterday I sometimes departed from my intent to use it. Usage vocabulary and usage rhetoric, but just something to notice as one reads. So formulaic hypotheticals, which are in essence pragmatic markers in the discourse grammar proposal, have the following properties. They are syntactically independent. They tend to be set up prosodically from the rest of the sentence. They tend to be positionally mobile, and their internal structure is built on principles of sentence grammar, but they can be elliptic, such as we hope. Their meaning is non-restricted. That means it's not an inherent part of the structure of a sentence or its constituents, but relates to the situation of discourse. And the situation of discourse concerns text organization, source of information. So who said this? Attitudes of the speaker. After all, is it justification attitude? Speaker-hearer interaction. So those are the ones that are headed and politeness markers, discourse setting, those would be things that might not be pragmatic markers, but they could certainly be so. I mean, if you think of topic changes and so forth, and world knowledge. In other words, they are mostly pragmatic markers. Co-optation is said to be a synchronic operation and instantaneous. Because it is instantaneous, it is unlike grammaticalization, which is gradual, according to Heine and his colleagues. In some cases, there may be a tripartite trajectory. And again, this is in the book. Internal grammaticalization followed by co-optation followed by further grammaticalization. So they've not got rid of grammaticalization, but they have split it up in an interesting way into three parts. Something that can happen within sentence grammar, and that is usually univerbation and sometimes some bleaching. Then the expression is co-opted, according to them, instantaneously and used externally in the initial position, final position, perhaps medial position, where it can undergo further grammaticalization. And that kind of trajectory is posited for phrases that are univerbated, like in fact, indeed. Sometimes, they claim, co-optation may occur first and then be followed by grammaticalization. Their example is anyway. So I'm not sure that there's evidence of that, and I'm not sure how you could get something in initial position that is co-opted as a kind of pragmatic element and then grammaticalize it by bleaching it. But anyway, that they propose that. And drawing on Britain's 2008 example of I mean, Heine 2013 finds no convincing evidence for a gradual transition from sentence grammar to thetical grammar. But he cites examples provided by Britain of indeterminate structures in Middle English, in which I mean has its full content meaning used in initial position and is followed by a that plus complement. The idea is that you can have a fully contentful I mean and say, I mean that that is a problem. And you can say, I mean that is a problem. The second one did not have the complementizer that in it. It's a thatless I mean. In such contexts, it is hypothesized I mean can be interpreted either as a matrix clause introducing a complementation or as the adverbial namely, as in an example I'm going to cite in a moment. You may have seen many examples of claims that I think originates in exactly this kind of context, that I think was originally a main verb with a complement that I think that something. And in thatless uses, I think he came. I think he arrived yesterday. There's no that there. I think was able to be used, was enabled use as a pragmatic marker. Thompson and Mulex had just did that in 1991, and people have systematically assumed that any kind of cause of that sort arises from a thatless complement structure. Britain has fought that argument many times, but we still find it being repeated over and over again. It's an interesting case here. Let's look at four. I mean, Master Geoffrey Chaucer has translated this said work out of Latin into our usual and border tongue. I mean, Master Geoffrey Chaucer has translated this work that I've just referred to, from Latin into our ordinary mother tongue. That's a quotation from Caxton's Prologues and Epilogues. It appears in the Helsinki Corpus, which is HC, and it is cited that way in Britain 2008. Heine picks up on it and said, aha, here is an I mean that looks like it's fully contentful. I mean, and a thatless clause. It means it's a variant on I mean that Master Geoffrey Chaucer has translated this said work. I think there are several problems with this particular analysis, and it's one of, as I said, very many, because this kind of argument is made for, I think, you know, and very many other clausal pragmatic markers. They're not discourse structuring markers, but they are pragmatic markers. Heine says that this particular example that I just cited is ambiguous. It's ambiguous between an I mean and a that-less complementizer here, and an I mean that is a pragmatic marker, like an explanatory pragmatic marker. The explanatory pragmatic marker would be co-opted, would not occur in a gradual change, but would be an instantaneous change. But those, particularly Heine himself and myself, have treated ambiguous examples, intermediate examples, as among evidence for gradual change. So if that example is indeed ambiguous, it doesn't appear to be an obvious example of co-optation, which is supposed to be instantaneous. Another problem is that Brinton questions whether the pragmatic marker I mean was in fact derived from a matrix clause introducing a complementation, because the complementation structures are very rare in the corpora she investigated. That, of course, doesn't mean it was impossible for I mean to be derived from a matrix clause. It just means that there is no evidence for it because it is very rare. And she suggests that the source of pragmatic marker I mean may well have been the structures of type I mean X, where X is a noun phrase, a verb phrase, an adjective phrase, a preposition phrase, or an adverbial phrase, but not a clause. As I mentioned, people find that very hard to believe in the case of these pragmatic markers that consist of a subject and a verb. But she has pointed to the sort of origin of many of them. Now, very unfortunately, she didn't cite four in context. But it was retrievable because it's in the Helsinki corpus. So I went to the Helsinki corpus and I put it in context. And I will show it in five. And I ask you to think as I read it, is it plausibly derived from a matrix clause when you see the context? Therefore, the worshipful father and first founder and embellisher of ornate eloquence in our English, I mean Master Geoffrey Chaucer, hath translated this said work out of Latin into our usual and modern tongue. Now, the way I read it, I did not read it as if I mean was a main clause. I gave it a prosody for the syntax that I think it has there, and that Brinton would certainly say it has there. The worshipful father and founder and embellisher of ornate eloquence in our English, who is Master Geoffrey Chaucer. So I mean NP has translated this work out of Latin into our mother tongue. I mean, Master Geoffrey Chaucer is appositional to father and founder and embellisher. It's not the complement of I mean. It is quite ambiguously, I think, of the type I mean, MP. There's no possible way here of having that. Therefore, the worshipful father and first founder and embellisher of ornate eloquence in English, I mean that Master Geoffrey Chaucer has translated this work. That makes no sense. So I think this is another example of what I've tried to drive home every time. Context matters, and if possible, one needs to go look for it. So I just said there's no evidence of that deletion. There's no evidence of instantaneous development because there are many, many examples. of I mean being with introducing noun phrases. Now, of course, an individual innovation is instantaneous. There's no question about that. But that's true for every construct, and it's not going to differentiate a particle from anything else. A conventionalized change cannot be instantaneous. I explained that the other day. A conventionalized change is one that has come to be shared by a community of speakers or writers. And I mean in that sense of which is an explanatory marker, is very well attested. It is very clearly conventionalized at Chaucer's time and later. Heine et al. Suggested after all was co-opted, and I don't think there's any evidence that it was. They say, co-optation for purposes of discourse structuring must have taken place in the second half of the 17th century, with after all now typically occurring clause initially, but frequently preceded by contrastive conjunctions like but or yet. I did cite an example yesterday with a yet. It was an although yet construction. So they have a different one. My lord avoided speaking with him while I walked up and down with my lord above an hour. And yet, after all, there had been so little ground for his jealousy of me that I'm sometimes afraid that he do this only in policy to bring me to his side by scaring me. That example was cited by Diana Lewis in her dissertation in 2000. It is absolutely true that after all there occurs after a yet, it means a justification. But it could also mean despite everything, but mainly it's a justification. It's one of those multi-interpretable uses that I talked about yesterday. It's not always clear, it's rather undecidable which use we're finding of after you all, especially when it's in the context of a contrastive, like yet. But my point is, what evidence is there that this was co-opted in their sense? I had evidence that after all was used in the sense after everything as a topicalized marker. So it was in the proper place for something that could be a pragmatic marker for a long time. We do find these examples like after all, but they seem to be bleaching examples in the context where they already were. This after all was already available in the topicalized initial position in the sentence. So I would argue there's no evidence of instantaneous development in either the I mean example or the after all example. Who knows? Heine and his colleagues say of six, and just to remember what six is, this is the example, my lord avoided speaking with him while I walked up and down with him, the lord, for over an hour. And yet, after all, I'm finding different. All right. I'm sorry, this computer is living a life of its own, but here we are. And yet, after all, there has been so little ground for his jealousy of me that I'm sometimes afraid he do this only in policy to bring me to his side by scaring me. Okay, that's his six. And Heine and his colleagues say of six, after all, does not seem to be part of the meaning of the sentence. I would agree with that. It's not an argument of the sentence. It no longer needs to refer to immediately preceding events. I agree with that. It seems to be prosodically set off from its environment. Yes. And it is no longer a syntactic constituent of the sentence. All of that is true, but that does not entail that it's a co-optation, in my view, because, as I said, after all, could be topicalized earlier and appear in that particular position. And it's a position that pragmatic markers appear in. So it was very easy for speakers, I think, and hearers, to interpret it as a contact. I have a feeling when I read the work on co-optation that not being a constituent of a sentence or clause seems to be the essential factor in characterizing after all as having come to be used as a thetical or any other marker, like I mean. Lewis says, after all, in that example in six, that it can be interpreted either as a PP, so as an adverbial, or as an adverb, depending on how far it has lexicalized. That is, it can be interpreted as either a temporal PP, meaning after everything, or as an adverb, meaning in the end. So on her interpretation, it's not actually a pragmatic marker at all there. It is an adverb. It is either a temporal adverb or it's an inferential in the end adverb. And if that is correct, which seems plausible, after all is part of the meaning of the sentence of six. Here we are again. My lord avoided speaking with him while I walked up and down with my lord above an hour, and yet, in the end, there has been so little ground for his jealousy. Or yet, after everything is said and done, there has been so little ground in his jealousy. That's what she's suggesting. I actually think Heine and his colleagues are probably correct that that could be, it could well be a pragmatic market there. We don't know. Came back to this because I wanted to say, look at the punctuation. Heine et al. Take the punctuation very seriously. But this is in a diary of 1663 by Samuel Pepys, written at a time when punctuation was not formalized as it is now. This book by Parks, which was written a while back in 1992, is a very good analysis of how most of the punctuation up to the 18th century was primarily a kind of prosodic punctuation and had nothing to do with what we think it does in modern practices. In any event, whatever the reading, if it's an adverb, it's topicalized, and that's the contextual use that I consider to be an essential step to constructionalization. It's a step in gradual development. Now you may wonder why I'm looking at examples that are so very difficult to analyze. And I'm looking at them because underdeterminacy is the game in town when you're looking at pragmatic markers. You cannot always tell. You have to look at the context, and you have to look in the light of your particular theory, and you have to make as plausible an argument as you can. Lewis made her argument that these were adverbials. Heine and his colleagues made their argument that this was a pragmatic marker. I'm suggesting that it's not implausible that it was intended one way and interpreted the other way. That's how change happens. speaker means something, and here, reader, linguist, find something else. So, back to the discourse structure model of Heine and his colleagues. Where does grammaticalization fit in it? The proposal is that grammaticalization and co-optation are different mechanisms. Grammaticalization is gradual, co-optation is instantaneous. As I mentioned, there can be grammaticalization before co-optation, while an expression is still part of the sentence grammar. Examples that they give are chunking and fixing and univerbation of I mean, I've added, by the way. There may be grammaticalization after co-optation, and that's typically morphological reduction, and in Heine's view, less frequently, desemanticization. So some kind of bleaching of the meaning after co-optation. I think you probably have to have some bleaching before co-optation, if co-optation is an acceptable interpretation of what's going on. The extent to which grammaticalization affects an expression is item specific. So for example, after all the same have been substantially desemanticized, but I mean very little. So each pragmatic marker, as has been pointed out many times, has its own history. And some are more semanticized, desemanticized than others. Some are more subjective than others. Some are intersubjective and not subjective. They are very different. You cannot really generalize very much about exactly what will happen. Each one has its own trajectory. Now, Heine and his colleagues, when presenting discourse grammar, make a sharp contrast between sentence grammar and thetical grammar. Sentence grammar is the standard syntactic type of grammar that was developed for 2 millennia. And the thetical grammar is everything else that is some kind of supplement and is in some way an add-on. Now, the sharp distinction that I've just characterized has been shown not to be supported by data from Japanese. Izutsu and Izutsu 2020 discuss sequences of pragmatic particles in utterance final position in Japanese that suggests that there is a continuum from more contentful to less contentful. And that's really what we find with the discourse structuring markers. There are some that are very contentful. I'm going to talk about them, things like instead and further, and some that are very pragmatic, and there's everything in between. Izutsu and Izutsu argue that this distinction that is made in discourse grammar doesn't hold up when you look at sequences of pragmatic particles in Japanese. They occur in final position because Japanese is an obi language. I think if you do historical work, and of course Heine and colleagues do, or at least they draw on historical work, when you do it, if a dual level grammar is preferred, there's a continuum between levels, not abrupt contrast between sentence grammar and the various kinds of theticals that they discuss. I would think that connective discourse structuring markers would be on that continuum, as they contribute to discourse connectedness. They are cause initial, but they appear not always to be marked off personality. But I really don't see a reason to prefer a dual level model of grammar over a mono-level one. Construction grammar is mono-layered and no distinction is made between sentence grammar and emphatical grammar. And there's no imperative to treat expressions that conform to internal constituency of the clause from those that do not. In fact, and this is the theoretical point here, a separate treatment would violate Goldberg's famous statement, "It's constructions all the way down." Now, it's admittedly an overstatement, and I will discuss that when I talk about the question whether position is a construction. I don't think it is, but she did say it's constructions all the way down. And the reason for saying it is that she wanted to highlight the unity of construction grammar. Construction grammar is made up of constructions in the constructicon that are in a network. And the idea is really anathema to construction grammar, that there should be such a complete divide between sentence grammar and emphatical grammar that is proposed in discourse grammar. And because constructions are assembled, different degrees of tightness of organization can be accounted for in a gradient from informal spoken conversation to formal, largely written registers. I'm arguing in these lectures that from a constructionist perspective, grammar understood as knowledge of language must be conceptualized as encompassing pragmatic expressions, although in some constructionist researchers' practice, no mention has been made of them. And when I say that, I really do recognize we cannot, and in fact, we should not try to do everything. But I do think that we could mention pragmatics at greater length in handbook articles and general articles that talk about the agenda of a particular model of construction grammar. So that brings me to the end of what I want to talk about today. And next time, I will return to some historical data, and particularly I'm going to talk about elaborative discourse structuring markers, like also for the more, moreover, and how they arose. And meanwhile, I wish you all a good weekend and hope to have some more of your really interesting questions and comments. Thank you.